Israel carries out new airstrikes on residential buildings south of the Gaza Strip, killing at least three more Palestinians while injuring several others. The UN Secretary General has condemned Israel's killing of civilians and strikes on the Gaza Strip as unacceptable, saying they must cease immediately. And Russia says it's achieved certain goals in a special military operation in Ukraine and has severely damaged a Ukrainian military machine. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, Israel has carried out fresh airstrikes on Gaza, targeting an apartment building in the southern part of the coastal strip. Attack has so far left at least three people dead and several injured. It's also resulted in complete destruction of the apartment building. Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military arm of the Islamic Jihad movement, confirmed that one of its commanders has been killed in this attack. This is the third day of Israeli aggression on Gaza. Regime started its attacks on the territory on Tuesday, and since then, over two dozen Palestinians have been killed, including several senior members of the Islamic Jihad movement, along with their family members, including many women and children. Now, Palestinians have fired barrages of rockets on occupied territories in response to the regime's assaults. Israeli military claims that it's intercepted the rockets, but media reported that building was hit in the town of Sidorat. The Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations has strongly condemned deadly Israeli airstrikes that targeted residential buildings in the besieged Gaza Strip. Riyad Mansour has urged UN Security Council to shoulder responsibility and take action against Israeli crimes. He's also expressed hope the ongoing attacks on Gaza will end immediately.
Of course, we condemn this crime. We condemn those who committed these crimes, particularly killing large number of children and women, and we believe that it is the duty of the Security Council to condemn these crimes and to pronounce that those from the Israeli side who planned these crimes, who have committed these crimes, should face accountability and should pay for their crimes. We sincerely hope that this aggression to stop against our people immediately. And we sincerely hope that the Security Council and the international community can condemn in clear terms the killing of children and women and to go after those who have organized this massacre against them and to make them face justice and pay the price that they deserve. We will see what the Security Council will do after 3 o'clock, but we will continue to keep knocking on the door for the Security Council to shoulder its responsibilities. They have many resolutions. We need protection from this savage attacks by the Israeli army and the settlers, whether in Nablus, in Jenin, in Jericho, in Jerusalem, in Ramallah, in Bethlehem, in Al-Khalil, and in every part of the occupied Palestinian territory. And definitely, we need them to stop their aggressions and attacks against our people in the besieged Gaza Strip, as we have seen since, you know, the early hours of yesterday.
Earlier, Chris Williamson, host of Palestine Declassified Program, said Israel is not able to deal with Palestinian resistance, retaliatory response to its attacks.
But in terms of the resistance, we know that there's unprecedented unity now across Palestine in terms of the resistance, the kind of axis of resistance as it's known, right across all the different factions. So, you know, one of the things which I think, you know, the Israelis are finding difficult to come to terms with is the effectiveness now of the resistance and the ability of the resistance to strike back. And I think we will certainly see a response from the resistance to this latest brutal atrocity by the Zionist entity. Very senior figures in the Zionist entity who have talked in terms of the regime and the whole Zionist edifice actually, you know, crumbling. You know, very senior figures, former prime minister, have said that, you know, they fear that the Zionist project could end before the end of this decade. So I think, you know, the brave talk from Netanyahu, but, I mean, the reality is that, you know, the tide of history is against them. The effectiveness of the resistance is growing. International opinion is increasingly critical of the Zionist regime. And I think that, you know, the writing is on the wall, frankly, for a substantial change and the, you know, the fortunes of the settler colony there is very much in doubt now. And, you know, what we need now, of course, though, is to push our politicians in the West to actually, you know, recognize that they are supporting the last brutal apartheid regime on the globe.
Meanwhile, the UN chief has condemned killings of civilians and Israel's strikes on Gaza as unacceptable, saying must stop immediately. Spokesman for Antonio Guterres said Israel must abide by obligations under international humanitarian law, including proportional use of force. Farhan Haq added regime must also take all feasible precautions to spare civilians and civilian targets in its strikes. Haq said closure of the Gaza border crossings by the regime has prevented the entry of vital foodstuff and medicine into the besieged enclave. The Arab League has also called on the International Criminal Court to complete its criminal probe into Israel's war crimes and crimes against humanity. Body said that Israel has committed various crimes, including settlement construction, aggression against cities, killing of civilians, and forced displacement of Palestinians. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad received an invitation to attend next week's Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi King Salman has invited Assad to attend the summit as the body agreed to bring Syria back into its fold after years of suspension. Assad says the summit, set to be held in Jeddah, will enhance joint Arab action to achieve shared aspirations. Invitation was made today after Riyadh and Damascus announced a reactivation of their diplomatic missions. Riyadh cut its diplomatic ties with Damascus in the wake of foreign-backed militancy in Syria starting back in 2011. And now rapprochement between Syria and Arab states comes as Syrian armed forces have managed to score victories against those foreign-backed elements. Political commentator Tim Anderson is of the opinion the Arab countries want to reassert their influence in the region in new ways now that the war on Syria has failed.
So there are contradictions in that. There are contradictions in the Bahraini regime, the UAE, in their normalization. But at the same time, they reestablish relations with Syria. They want to be relevant. That's really what's driven this. They don't want to be left out. They see that the dirty war on Syria has failed. And all of those states want to have reassert their influence in some new ways in the new reality of the region. That's what's going on. But they can't just immediately abandon all of the relations they've had with the U.S. After all, they've acted in U.S. interests for many, many years. And it's going to be interesting to see how they try and disentangle themselves from this relationship, because, of course, the U.S. is not, it may be a declining power, but it's not harmless. It's capable of doing some real damage, particularly to its collaborators, which are seen to betray them or go in a different direction. We've seen what they've done with collaborators in many other countries in the past.
Now, Russia says it's achieved certain goals in its special military operation in Ukraine, stressing operation will continue. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said Russia has severely damaged the Ukrainian military machine. He, however, admitted operation has been very difficult. Peskov said Ukraine's continued shelling of eastern parts of the country taken by Russia demonstrates the need to continue the operation to push back pro-Kiev forces. He added Russia's launched countless missile strikes against military targets throughout the country. Ukraine has accused Russia of hitting civilian targets, an accusation Moscow denies. And now, following a quadrilateral meeting in Moscow, foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria, and Turkey have agreed to prepare a roadmap aimed at promoting relations between Damascus and Ankara. Marina Kortanova has your story.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of their permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the UN. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the UN humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same UN to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A two-day conference dubbed the New World Order Geometry has kicked off in the Iranian capital with the presence of attendees from dozens of countries. The event has been inspired by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution's call for universities and academics to play a key role in the creation of a new world order. Matthew Abbasian reports.
An international conference on the New World Order geometry has kicked off in Iran's capital, Tehran. Hosted by the University of National Defense, several high-ranking Iranian officials, as well as over 180 scholars, experts and thinkers from 360 countries including China, Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Oman, Syria and Iraq have attended this event. The two-day event discusses issues related to the formation of a new world order. Addressing the conference during the inauguration ceremony, Chief of Staff of Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Hossein Bagheri, said the Islamic Revolution has been one of the pillars to fight against the U.S. hegemonic agenda around the globe. Bagheri also said the U.S. attempts to rule over the world have ended in failure.
The governance of the world by hegemonic powers will fail. The signs of the decline of the U.S.'s power became obvious after the pullout of American forces from Iraq and Afghanistan, the remarkable reduction of U.S. troops in West Asia, as well as the U.S.'s confusion of the deployment of military forces to West Asia, south of China and west of Europe.
Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf was also among the speakers of the opening ceremony.
He said the world order is witnessing a change in favor of the oppressed, in which the Islamic Revolution plays a key role.
At the beginning of this meeting, when we all look at it fairly, we understand that if such opportunities are provided today for the humanity, the Islamic society, and the Islamic world, we will witness a change in the new world order for the benefit of humanity, freedom, and Muslims.
In recent years, different geopolitical developments have led to the decline of the West's unipolar hegemony. Iran, as one of the most important actors in the regional and global stage, plays a key role in the new world order.
Last year, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei announced that the world is on the threshold of a new order. This international conference is a testimony that Tehran is not only serious about the issue, but intends to play a major role in creating a new multipolar world order. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
European Union's foreign policy towards Africa is slated as the humanitarian situation in Sudan deteriorates. There have been calls throughout the European Parliament for the bloc to provide asylum to Sudanese refugees amid heavy clashes between rival military factions. Jerome Hughes reports out of Brussels.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the rapid support forces versus the Sudanese armed forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize a de facto military dictatorship because this is the arrangement that has served their financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds, and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticized for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda. I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with an aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. U.S. banking crisis has deepened. PacWest is the latest American bank to see its stocks plunge following the collapse of several rivals. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Reuters reported shares of PacWest Bancorp dragging other regional lenders down after the Los Angeles-based bank's plan to explore strategic options sparked investor worries of a widening financial crisis. PacWest's stock slumped more than 40% in afternoon trading, dropping to a record low. The bank had confirmed an earlier Reuters report that it was exploring strategic options, including a potential sale or capital raising. First Republic's collapse, the third major casualty of the biggest crisis to hit the U.S. banking sector since 2008, rekindled a slide in shares of regional lenders, despite regulatory efforts to stanch the turmoil that began with the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in March. U.S. officials at the federal and state levels are assessing the possibility of market manipulation behind big moves in banking share prices in recent days, a source familiar with the matter told Reuters. According to RT, regional lender PacWest Bancorp has become the latest American bank to be caught up in the worst crisis in the sector since 2008. The bank has confirmed it is in talks with potential partners and investors about the strategic options, following a 60% stock route. Shares in the bank nosedived in after hours U.S. trading recently over reports the Los Angeles-based lender was mulling a sale. PacWest shares were down as much as 48% in early trading recently. The bank has not experienced out-of-the-ordinary deposit flows following the sale of First Republic Bank and other news. PacWest stated recently, adding, "Our cash and available liquidity remained solid and exceeded our uninsured deposits." According to the lender, discussions with potential buyers and investors are ongoing, and the company will continue to evaluate all options to maximize shareholder value. People familiar with the matter told Bloomberg that PacWest has been considering a breakup or a capital raise. A buyer would potentially have to book a big loss, marking down some of the bank's loans, sources said. PacWest's sell-off followed U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's announcement that authorities were closer to containing the turmoil that has gripped the banking sector. Powell claimed that the government seizure and sale of a struggling First Republic Bank of J.P. Morgan Chase was an important step toward drawing a line under that period of severe stress for regional lenders. First Republic became the fourth U.S. lender to collapse this year, following Silvergate Capital, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank. Meanwhile, chief market analyst at KCM Trade, Tim Waterer, told Bloomberg that the Fed's statement offers little in the way of confidence for the market. Despite the best efforts by Jerome Powell to calm the market, there is nothing to suggest that the banking crisis is at an end, he claimed. Meanwhile, there are reports that two more U.S. regional banks saw trading of their shares suspended recently amid the worst crisis to hit the country's financial sector since 2008. Regulators halted trading in Los Angeles-based PacWest and Arizona's Western Alliance after their share prices fell dramatically. PacWest Bancorp said recently it was in talks with potential partners and investors about the strategic options after its shares dropped by as much as 60%. The bank announced recently the company has been approached by several potential partners and investors. Discussions are ongoing. But investors were not reassured and the sell-off continued. PacWest shares fell 50% and affected other regional banks. Western Alliance plunged 45% before trading was halted. The bank's stock has shed more than 60% of its value so far this year. Another mid-sized bank, First Horizon, lost almost 40% of its value recently after Canada's Toronto Dominion Bank Group scrapped its planned $13.4 billion takeover of the lender. We are running out of time to fix this problem. How many more unnecessary bank failures do we need to watch before FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and our government wake up? We need a system-wide deposit guarantee regime now. Bill Ackman, the CEO of the New York hedge fund Pershing Square, said. He warned that the entire U.S. regional banking system is at risk, saying, "Confidence in a financial institution is built over decades and destroyed in days." The development comes after another mid-sized bank, First Republic, was seized by U.S. regulators and sold to J.P. Morgan. Depositors had pulled $100 billion from First Republic, fearing their money was no longer safe. First Republic became the fourth U.S. lender to collapse this year, following Silvergate Capital, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank.
Food for thought.
Salam. And how about beginning the day by pondering upon an excellent piece of advice from Imam Ali, peace upon him, the first infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Do not sit to a table on which there is wine, because no one can guess the very hour in which his soul is grasped.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran
by a shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how can I get rid of nightmares? In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may His peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and His pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salaamu Alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me today. We're going to start our program today with a kind of weird question, and that is, my dreams are nightmares. Would you please show me a cure for my bad predicament before my youth wastes away? Some people may suffer from this problem, so we're going through the answer. So we know some dreams, as psychologists have proven, are a reflection of one's psychological worry during wakefulness, during the day. So, to cure yourself, you have to follow the principles I'm going to offer in this session. Firstly, and I think the most important one, is to purify your daily activities from unlawful things. And if something unlawful takes place, purify it by asking Allah for forgiveness. Because if we commit an unlawful action, we feel guilty. And feeling guilty has got a ruining effect on our soul and our heart, and it makes everything as a nightmare. And secondly, we need to be satisfied with what Allah has given you: wealth, beauty, health, and the like. Thirdly, perform ablution before sleeping and recite a portion of the Holy Quran. And when you lie in your bed, think of what you have recited or try to sleep while thinking good thoughts. It is also a very practical principle that if someone wants to get rid of nightmares, must follow this principle as well. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for the second part. So we were talking about the ways of getting rid of nightmares, and the first way we offered was to purify our daily activities. And secondly, we need to feel satisfied, and we need to be satisfied with the blessings of Allah, with what Allah has given us, from wealth, beauty, health, and the like. And also, it's very important, if you're suffering from nightmares, to perform ablution, wudu, before sleeping, and if it is possible, to recite a portion of the Holy Quran, and when we want to sleep and when we lie in our bed, we need to think about what we have recited from Quran, and also try to sleep while you are thinking about good thoughts. But fourthly, if we want to continue the principles that we can get them through Quran and Hadiths, that is to be certain that those who have been happy in their lives have faced problems too, and that their lives are not free from troubles now. But they are well aware that worrying is a problem much greater than those problems. So why would they increase their troubles by worrying when they need to decrease them? Nightmares come from feeling worried during the day. And there is no reason for feeling worried, and we need to decrease this feeling by relying on God and by following His principles. Fifthly, and the last one, we need to remind ourselves of our good actions and successful deeds, and do not think of our failures and shortcomings. Everyone has bright pages in his life, and even the successful and great people are not free from defects. Dear young man, dear my brother, dear my sister, set out in the way towards Allah the Almighty and rely on Him. This is the only way we can rid of our nightmares during the night and during the day. I hope everyone a life without nightmares. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Central Africans. Tanks and armed men. The mood in front of the Bengui Stadium with its 20,000 seats is tense this morning. Just a few months ago, a civil war raged in the country. The 30th of March 2016 is a historic day, and nothing is supposed to ruin the first democratically elected president's inauguration. To many, this event marks the beginning of reconciliation and rebuilding of this bled-out country. The celebration reflects the nation's great hope. Backstage, there is much nervousness. Radio Ndeka Luka is testing the equipment before its live show. Reporters comment on every minute of this festive event. The station's director herself is reporting. Neither the press nor the people want to miss this moment, despite the blazing heat. The new president will indeed have to work miracles to put this country out of its misery. In November 2015, the Pope pacified the deep hatred between Christians and Muslims. But this peace is brittle. Millions of Central Africans listen to Ndeka Luka, whose name means bird of hope in Sango. Security guard Narcisse is controlling the entrances. During the Civil War, he was on the front lines. Enraged armed persons brought mutilated corpses here to have the radio station report on it. Supporters of both groups have stormed the office several times, threatening to kill the journalists. As the station refused to take sides, both camps extorted it. Its Christian director Sylvie and Muslim head editor Jean-Claude Ali have never cowed to the pressure. They consider information to be a tool against violence. After 15 rough years, the editors hope for better times. The head editor is full of hope, but nothing is definite yet. In these uncertain times, the radio station is the only constant and is campaigning for reconciliation. The director and two journalists are preparing the next episode in the adjoining office. Fred and I explain why they want to invite former Christian warlord Emotion to the discussion panel. The popular show now acts as protection against violence. Enemies who once wanted to kill each other now have a discussion. But they are indeed nervous right before entering the studio. Following this downright sensational handshake of former archenemies, we leave the station and immerse ourselves in the crowd in Bangui with a special guide. Emotion doesn't hide his past. But the Christian and animistic militias didn't just fight back, but systematically took revenge on all Muslims. The so-called anti-Balaka also spread fear with lynching and crimes like cannibalism. Everyone knows the former anti-Balaka speaker is guilty. But the feared yet respected man receives a hero's welcome in all Christian neighborhoods. The contrite warrior now tends to victims of the conflict. We visit the Botango camp in Bairabi in the 4th district. 159 people came here to flee the militia's atrocities and have lived in poverty for 3 years. Even the poorest have pinned their hopes on the new president. The extent of the destruction illustrates the Salika militia's brute force. Survivors share their misery and show us what remained of their neighborhood called Fatima. Municipal administrator Marius accompanies Emotion. How many lives did this contrite warrior end himself? A delicate question, but the radio station's employees prefer to focus on the future. Ndeka Luka is the only voice of trust in this destroyed and disorganized country, like a big sister whom you confide in or ask for advice. As the only independent radio station airing around the clock, it acts as the people's voice. Guard Etienne is helping Hippolyte Le Français. The advertising editor is proud of working for this station. His reception desk is a real treasure trove. Hippolyte keeps everything and gives his best to return finds to their owners. Dinicourt is the station's star during lunchtime. His two-hour show puts people into a good mood and reduces tension. The vivacious young man is the country's most popular radio host. This true friend warned them of the attacks and lootings. The radio has much influence and also much responsibility in a country where few have access to television. The station often sends reporters on site to fulfill its mission. Etta and Fred are driving to the Muslim district, kilometer 5. The anti-Balaka rioted there to avenge the Muslim Seleka militia's crimes. The two journalists guarantee our safety. Rebels from Chad and Sudan have yet to be disarmed here, but at least trade has commenced again. The Muslim enclave, kilometer 5, is the nation's economic center. Etta interviews the merchant's representative. Abdul still remembers the days when he cleansed corpses, but the Pope made him feel hopeful again. The Pope's visit has smoothed ruffled feelings, and trade is flourishing again. People here also see the new president as a man of providence. Bertil's report, The World of the Smallest, shows the neighborhood John the 23rd in the 4th district. The children are to learn about the topic of reunion, too. Bertil wins the little one's trust with warmth and tact, learning to forgive. These words resonate with many Central Africans, who desire peace now more than ever before. Here, where two-thirds are still illiterate, education seems to be the key to a better future.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Palestinians say the Zionist regime's siege on Gaza has crippled the enclave's economy. The fishing zone for the Gazans currently extends to only between 11 kilometers and 28 kilometers off the Gaza coast. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, It is early morning, sunny but with a cool breeze. Jihad Al-Hissi is busy helping fellow fishers to prepare a boat for a day at sea. There should not be anything unusual about the tasks they perform. Fishers around the world do them all the time. Yet the tension is almost palpable. Jihad 56 is worried that his boat will not return to the port. For 8 months last year, the boat was held by Israeli authorities after its crew ventured a short distance beyond the small zone in which Gaza's fishers are permitted to operate. Being away from the vessel was heartbreaking for Jihad. "Feeding our families was very hard during those months," he said, adding, "All we know how to do is in life is fish." Eventually, the boat, named Al-Hajj Rajab, after Jihad's father, was released to him under strict conditions. He was required to pay approximately $5,500 and warned that he may not go further than 3 nautical miles from the shoreline. Jihad fears that the boat could be seized once again at any moment. The Israeli regime authorities have initiated court proceedings in an effort to confiscate the boat permanently. The ordeal began on February 14, 2022. On that day, Jihad's brother, Nihad, was captaining the boat. Nihad and other members of his extended family were lowering their nets into the sea when 3 Israeli regime naval vessels approached them at high speed. The Israelis attacked Nihad and his crew with rubber-coated steel bullets and water cannons. Once they were beside the boat, 3 Israeli regime commandos jumped on board, screaming and continuing to shoot. Nihad said, "They even used electric shock weapons on us several times. It was the most terrifying and cruel experience of my life," he added. "Not only because I was in danger, but because it was hard to see my sons and nephews injured and in handcuffs." All 6 fishers, including Nihad, were arrested and brought to Ashdod, a naval base in the occupied territories of Palestine. Later, the fishers were taken to the Erez military checkpoint, which separates the occupied territories and Gaza. They were interrogated before being released in the late evening. The excuse offered by the Zionist regime for its brutality was that the boat was outside the permitted fishing area. Nihad pointed out that it is often impossible to catch enough fish inside the permitted zone. Fishers have to go farther in the hope they will have a large enough daily catch. Otherwise, their activities would not be economically viable. Under the Oslo Accords signed between the Zionist regime and the Palestine Liberation Organization in the 1990s, Gaza's fishers may venture up to 20 nautical miles from the shore. The Zionist regime has not respected the accords. The Zionist regime has repeatedly changed the limits applying to fishers. At times, this regime has reduced the zone as little as 3 nautical miles and even banned fishers from going to sea completely for certain periods. While naval attacks on Gaza's fishers are frequent, the court proceedings the Zionist regime has initiated against the Al-Hissi family is regarded as unprecedented. According to Gisha, an Israeli human rights group, the authorities are wrongly trying to invoke provisions of international law. These provisions concern the seizure of enemy ships and, in Gisha's view, should not be applied to civilians. It is deeply ironic that the Zionist regime is posing as a defender of international law in this case. The restrictions the Israeli regime has imposed on fishers and the violence to which this regime has subjected them constitutes collective punishment. That crime is outlawed by the Fourth Geneva Convention, a cornerstone of international law. Al-Mizan, a Gaza-based human rights group, has found that the Zionist regime carried out hundreds of attacks on Palestinian fishers in 2022 alone. Such attacks have continued in the first few months of this year. The Zionist regime's seizure of his boat caused major problems for Jihad. As he had no income, his debts mounted. And when the boat was finally handed back to him, it had sustained serious damage. Some of the damage resulted directly from the attack. Other damage resulted from the boat's engine being exposed to the elements during the 8 months it was kept in Ashdod. Repairing it cost approximately $11,000. Jihad also lost nets and other fishing gear that had been cast into the sea just before the attack occurred. Replacing the equipment cost an additional $10,000. Jihad had to borrow heavily so that he could pay those bills. While many fishers have left the profession since the Zionist regime imposed the full blockade on the Gaza Strip in 2007, Jihad is determined to keep plying his trade. He regards it as his duty to do so, as he comes from a family of fishers. He recalls hearing stories that his father told him about working as a fisher in Jaffa. The family hails from that port city in historic Palestine. They moved to Gaza after being uprooted during the Nakba, the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Jihad said, "Even when my boat was taken away from me, I insisted on going down to the port in Gaza every morning. Life away from the sea's breeze is unbearable." In the meantime, Wafa News Agency reported on May 1st, 2023, Israeli regime navy attacked Palestinian fishermen while sailing off the northwest shores of Gaza City, injuring two and arresting two others. According to the fishermen union committees in the Gaza Strip, two Palestinian fishermen were shot and injured by Israeli regime's navy's rubber-coated steel bullets, including an injury to the head, while sailing within 3 nautical miles offshore the northwest of Gaza City. Israeli regime navy troops reportedly surrounded the boat, attacked it with rubber-coated steel bullets and water cannons, shooting and injuring two people. They were taken to hospital for medical treatment. In the meantime, Israeli regime army and bulldozers, on May 1st, infiltrated Gaza borders from the eastern part of Khan Yunis city in southern Gaza Strip and razed land in the area. Sources said that 7 Israeli military vehicles, accompanied by bulldozers, raided agricultural land to the east of the town Khaza, east of Khan Yunis, where they leveled land and vandalized Palestinian agricultural properties.